This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. I am home. I got my kids home today, and I'm taking it easy on the road the next few days with clients through Monday. I'll be back Tuesday, and I've got a couple projects I'm working on right now. Actually, I've got some food plots to put in, and that's a priority for me. I'm going to try to get my food plots in Tuesday or Wednesday. We've had some nice rain, and some of them are ready to go. I'm actually going to till the ground. I got to put some calcium in. Once I get that calcium in, and I think I got to get some zinc in. Once that's in, I'm good to go. And deer season will be here before you know it. If you are not getting your fall food plots in, this is the time, at least in the north, to get that rolling. I know a lot of my clients are asking questions, and what am I planning? And maybe we'll talk about that today. I've got a new guest here. We've talked offline a little bit, and I was actually introduced to him through a friend of mine. Who said, you got to check this guy out. And we've talked offline a little bit, and I think he's got a lot to contribute to the podcast. I want to say, you know, I think we have the brightest and the best on this, and I don't want to get him worried, but I think he fits in that category. So we're going to take advantage of his expertise and try to extract as much information out of him so we can learn a little bit. So let me get him on the line. Thomas, how are you doing, man?
Well, now I feel like there's a lot of pressure on me after that intro, but I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. That's what I try to do. I ramp it up. So you gotta succeed. Let's tell the audience a little bit about you, where you're from, a little bit about your business.
Yeah. So my name is Thomas Milsna. I'm the founder, owner, operator of The Untamed Ambition, which is a holistic land management company. Within there, I have a whitetail specific program, Whitetail Ambition. It's a coaching program habitat improvement, you know, all that jazz. I'm located in southwestern Wisconsin, so kind of the heart of the Midwest, if you want to call it that. I'm a stone's throw away from Minnesota, Iowa, and not too far from Illinois, honestly. So kind of right in that dream area, you know, the driftless area of the Midwest. And I grew up on a large dairy farm. My bread and butter and passion have all come from pursuing high caliber, mature whitetail bucks. That's kind of the drive behind everything that I do. And just living on the land my whole life is, you know, what kind of got me going with all this stuff.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Everyone has a different take on things depending on the way they grew up. I grew up in suburbia, sunny Syracuse, New York, the hotbed of deer hunting, upstate New York, giant bucks, 60 inches or greater. But, you know, there's differences between us, but there's a lot of similarities. And I think some of it has to do with just lifestyle. And I think a lot of people don't realize the significance, at least I pay attention to this now, is just how people live. And, you know, we got a big garden in my backyard. I do a lot of playing around with food plots and soil. And I've become a little smarter than I was a few years ago. And I've taken a lot of training. I better be smarter by all the money I spent into my education. But, you know, what makes you different from a lot of people? I kind of want to hit on that topic.
Well, people in general, I think I would agree with you. You know, you and I fall into a different category, and probably a lot of your listeners in general fall into a similar category, that we're more closely connected with the land because we're working on the land with the land. You know, we're paying attention to those details and just looking or observing things that a lot of people would just generally overlook. What makes me different in the consulting realm, you know, there's this massively growing industry of consultants out there, right? It's probably just experience more than anything, and education, just like you're saying. You know, I've invested a lot of time and money in education as well. I've got a college education in wildlife biology and natural resource management. I've went through all sorts of soils classes and training throughout the years, whether it was from specifically an agronomy standpoint or now more so on the conservation side of things. But I think the biggest thing that sets guys like us apart is the level of observation that we have. You know, we're not overlooking all the little details and hanging our hats on the flashy, shiny thing, you know, the whatever the trending, catchy topic is of the week. It's more so digging into those details. I mean, you just talked about your food plots here a minute ago and getting some calcium and some zinc down on those food plots. 95% of the guys out there doing food plots have never even considered adding micronutrients to a food plot. They just think about, you know, what does that soil sample say, if they're even taking a soil sample? And then, you know, what is that NPK breakdown? What do I need to put on there to get this crop to grow? You know, so a lot of what I do, and I know you're in the same mindset, but a lot of what I do is not just thinking about what are we doing today, tomorrow, this weekend, this season, but how are those decisions going to set us up for success down the road? And what is that long-term plan? How do we put all these things together? You know, one of the things I tell my clients all the time is every year is a building year. Every year is a building year. If you approach your season or your habitat improvements with that mindset, instead of like, oh, I got to get this done to kill this deer. Well, yes, we do want to think about the short term, right? But also every year is a building year. So, you know, think about that big goal. What are the low hanging fruits, the things you can do right now, but also always be working towards that big goal and not shorting yourself for some quick, you know, quick fix band-aid type solution. So level of observation and long-term thinking, I think are probably the biggest differences between guys like us and the average person out there.
Yeah, well said. And I certainly think that, you know, I think if people think about that and apply that to their daily lives, I think they'll be a little farther ahead than most. Now, let's get into some of the specifics. We had talked offline a few weeks ago and we talked about a whole bunch of things, but one of those topics we wanted to get into is just starting to get prepared for the season and taking data, either looking at data, collecting data, right? In this preparation of getting into hunting season, everyone's thinking about killing. Everyone's thinking about harvesting deer. That's a big piece of this equation. Now, the time and preparation you've put into you know, your property or your lease or whatever up to this point is critical. But there comes some point where you got to start analyzing and looking at how deer are using the landscape. And I think, you know, your background, right? You've got a lot of background in cameras. Maybe we should talk a little bit about taking data in, assessing it, and making some decisions based on that. I think that would be a good kind of process, because I think people are starting to get that mode. You know, me, I'm just getting some cameras out now. I've been a little bit lazy. In fact, the reason why I don't have cameras out right now is I don't want to collect any more data. I'm tired of looking at data, which, you know, I got to motivate myself, because it's important to have that data to start making those decisions. So I want to hear a little bit from you on that topic.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. Yesterday I slipped away for the afternoon. I had to run a trailer load of some stuff to our home farm. And while I was there, I went out and scouted one end of the property and threw a cell camera out. And that's kind of how I scout in general, you know, throughout the whole season. And obviously early season's not going to be any different, but I always try to start from the outside and work in. Now, I'm running cameras. You mentioned I have a background in cameras. I spent 10 years working for one of the top trail camera companies in the industry and learned a lot throughout those years. You know, I worked with some of the biggest names in the outdoor industry on the technology side. I went to college for wildlife biology and ended up working very closely with a lot of researchers in the field of technology. So I learned a lot about monitoring wildlife, you know, the surveillance aspect there, and how to collect data in general. And then, you know, twisted that into more of a whitetail hunting bias to use that information appropriately. And I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that trail cameras are one of the biggest factors in my success over the years. I mean, scouting, back to that level of observation, but scouting in general is obviously so valuable. And when you have a device that you can put out there that's going to scout certain aspects of that data collection for you when you're not there is very critical. Now, obviously there's some caveats that go with that, and you know, using them appropriately is going to either make or break you essentially. You know, there's a lot of guys that misuse cameras or just don't use them to their full potential, but no, I'm in the same boat. I just got out, put a couple cameras out. You know, in general, I always have a handful of cameras in consistent spots every single year. You know, those, especially when you have the advantage to manipulate habitat, improve habitat, you're going to have consistent travel corridors, obviously food plots, stuff like that. But I also have access to a fair chunk of land. And if I ran cameras across that whole thing, one, I would be paying a second mortgage and lithium batteries. And two, I would have so much information. I'm at the same point as you. I already have so much trail camera information that it's almost overwhelming to find the amount of time to sit down and go through it all. You know, that can be problematic in and of itself. And I've actually cut back significantly on the amount of cameras I've ran and compared to the past. I mean, when I worked for the trail camera company, my primary role was customer support. So I ran the technical service department. I did all the prototyping of new products. I built all the test equipment for the new cameras to go through during manufacturing. And then I supported all those products when they came back in. So I was constantly testing cameras all the time, whether it was a camera that came in with a complaint, wasn't working. Okay, let's put it out and see if we can figure out what's going on with it. Or new cameras, we're trying to test, you know, different times of the year. I mean, there was many days where I would drive out to the property at 3 o'clock in the morning to run tests on a camera because it was 40 below zero. And I wanted to test and see how it was functioning in those elements, you know, stuff like that. But I think at my peak on our home farm, I was running upwards of about 100 cameras across that farm. And, you know how it is. Sometimes you hit a fall and you're shifting cameras from here to there. You know, maybe you're trying to move them over to scrape sites or, you know, different pinch points, or, you know, I like to kind of shadow scrapes.
You forget where they are.
Well, it wasn't so much I would forget. Yeah. It was more so just I had access to those resources. So instead of moving a camera, I just add another camera, right? And I wasn't paying the bills on the batteries at that point in time because they were all quote unquote test cameras. But, you know, it's interesting. You learn a lot by doing that. But I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that you don't need that many cameras. You know, I think there's a common misconception that we can always add another camera, always add another camera. But it does go back to that information, and too much information can be very overwhelming. I'm more so in the mindset now, or and have been for the last 10 years, that the right information, you know, used correctly, you know, the significance of that information is more valuable than just having an influx of information that's overwhelming and you can't actually utilize it.
Yeah, let's get to the hot points though. Let's move on this. Let's get to the hot points. Or what are the activities or actions or information that are essential in your mind? Let's hit on those points.
Well, I think first and foremost, I want to start and talk about, you know, five major trail camera considerations, and then we can kind of roll into those hot points because,
okay,
you know, again, I think there's a lot of different elements and factors involved with trail cameras. First and foremost, what I tell all my clients, and I've told all my customers for a very long time, you know, I've literally worked with tens of thousands of trail camera users over the years. I always would tell them, rule number one with trail cameras is trail cameras only tell you where you should have been, not where you should be, right? In a cell camera, we all love our real-time information and instant gratification, but a cell camera just tells you where you should have been a lot sooner. You know, so by that, I mean, use those cameras to collect information and put together theories, build out a theory, and then you can use that camera again. And we'll get to the, you know, these elements that I look for here in a minute, but use that camera to build this theory and then test that theory. If you start to identify patterns, then write it down. Be like, oh, okay, I think that buck is here because of these elements, these factors, and then look for those conditions. And if he shows up again on camera, now you know. Or go out and hunt him if it's during season, and if he shows up there, now you know, right? And there can obviously be other variables involved, especially when you put a human in place of that camera and you're adding scent and activity, access, exit, stuff like that can alter those behaviors, but always one step closer to proving a theory or testing out a theory by collecting information and understanding how to get ahead or one step ahead of that buck instead of just chasing him all the time. And the second thing kind of goes along with that is, you know, trail cameras only tell you what's happening directly in front of them. And I think a lot of people overlook that. In the research world, we refer to that as a sampling rate. You know, that camera, most cameras, you know, they'll advertise detection range of whatever it might be, 80 feet, 100 feet. But in most setups, I generally get a detection range of about 20 to 30 feet, and that's by design. You know, I've got the camera mounted high, which is another rule of mine, you know, understand that pressure that those cameras put on. So in a tight, close quarter situation, on a trail in the woods, even on a scrape, something where there's the potential that a deer, specifically a mature buck, might be surprised by the presence of that object in the woods. And I'm not talking about a flash going off. I'm talking about a physical object that is there that is new to his environment, and he's going to notice that. The analogy I always used to use is, you know, if I went in your house and set a can of beer on your nightstand and you came home, you're going to notice that, you know, unless that's something that you habitually do is drink beer and set it on your nightstand, right? You're gonna notice that, and it's gonna make you uncomfortable. Someone's been in my house, someone's left something here, now I don't feel as safe. So anytime you have a camera in close quarters, raise it up, get it high, elevate it, you know, out of their eyesight, you know, their normal range, and then, you know, break up that outline, put it on a tree that's bigger than the profile of that camera. So with that camera raised up, usually mounted down, you do cut down your detection range because you're aimed at a more targeted area. I will on food plots or open areas, I will mount cameras lower where they can shoot out across that field. But in that situation, it seems like those bucks, you know, they can approach it from a distance. If they notice something that's off, they can make the choice. I'll get closer. You know, some, I say these things that people are like, ah, you know, I have bucks that lick the cameras and sniff them. And I've seen that too, but I've also seen the same deer sniff a camera and then later walk up to another camera, freak out, and never come back through that pinch point again. So every situation is a little bit different. But then my third rule, like, you know, again, all these things are interconnected, but my third rule is to be very intentional with those setups. Again, go out there trying to collect information. And the way that I present that to clients is, you know, this is part of that observation thing, is you should always be trying to ask questions, right? Don't go out there and just throw a camera up because there's a deer trail and I want to see what's running down that trail. You know, there might be a time and a place for that where you're just trying to collect information, maybe again, scouting from the outside in, but be more intentional with that setup. Look at what that area has to offer. You know, is that trail adjacent to a bedding area or connecting a bedding area to a food source? Is it a pinch point or is it just a random trail? If you're more intentional with that setup and you're asking specific questions, like the camera I put out yesterday is on a field edge. There was a fence crossing there. I threw in a mock scrape just to kind of slow those deer down. There was a scrape just down the way, but there's not a lot of good trees there. So I clipped off that scrape branch and I added a branch 20 yards closer to that setup. So now I'm monitoring a trail, I'm monitoring a food source, and I'm monitoring a scrape. And my goal there is very specifically to find out if there's a mature buck using that food source. And then from there, you know, I kind of zone in on them. But, you know, I've in the past put cameras out trying to understand if a buck is using a certain bedding area, not in the bedding area, but a trail adjacent to that bedding area or a pinch point adjacent to that bedding area. And in a situation like that, I get a lot of pictures of bucks on that camera and not a lot of pictures of does. And that told me that that most likely is a buck bedding area, because if you're getting a pile of pictures of does, chances are the buck's not bedding there, right? He's bedding further down the line away from that doe pressure. And then the last rule, you know, again, all these go hand in hand, but the last rule is to put high value on the information you're collecting from these cameras and save it, catalog it by location, by date, whether you go year in, year out, create a new folder, whatever your, you know, levels or layers of organization might be. I cannot put enough stress on saving that historical data, because then when it circles all the way back around to that camera telling you where you should have been, not where you should be, right? You can look at that historical information and go, okay, last year that buck was in this area a whole lot during this time frame. Now let's drill in a little bit deeper. What were those conditions? So what I break down, I refer to them as the four key elements: wind, pressure, food, and timing. So when I'm talking about wind, I'm talking about air movement. What direction is that wind coming from? What are the thermals doing? You know, the thermals are pretty consistent, right? Heat rises, cold air drops. So how are those thermals working with whatever the wind direction is on any given day? How is that air moving across the landscape? But the thing that you can quantify a lot more easily is just the wind direction. You can look at the forecasts, figure out what that is. You know, a lot of times it's not going to be exactly the same on site, depending on the topography or the vegetative cover. You know, where's an open spot, more heat, more cool air. But you can really dial in on that wind. And that wind, what I've found over the years, is what's going to place those bucks in their bedding areas. Wind at their back, back to cover. If you have a good bedding area, you know, again, if you went in there and you improved a bedding area and you kind of have an idea of how that buck's going to be positioned in there, then you understand the survival advantages that come with that bedding area. And he's going to rely on that wind more than anything. And then not only that, when that buck gets up out of that bed, depending on the level of pressure in the area, he's going to use the wind more or not, depending on that pressure again, but he's going to use that wind to move to or from that food source as that survival advantage. So then that second key,
Thomas, go ahead. When you talk about pressure, can you explain what you mean by that? Is that pressure from hunting pressure or social pressure from the herd? What pressure do you think is most impactful?
Yep. So the second key element is pressure. And I'm glad you brought it up that way. Most people be like, well, you're talking about barometric pressure, things like that. You know, I think those do have some element at play there. You know, they have some factors that might affect deer. But what I'm talking about very specifically is anything that causes stress or discomfort on a deer to a level that it's going to change their behavior. So when I break it down and, you know, I try to explain these things very thoroughly to clients. The first thing is your biological pressures that, you know, deer just go through changes throughout the year. We see it all the time. Right now they're fat and happy. The velvet's still on. Once that testosterone level increases, that biological pressure is increasing. You know, they're a lot more irritable when that velvet comes off. They're a lot more sensitive to their environment. Then you have the environmental pressure, right? Right now, all the leaves are on, the crops are up. There's a lot of cover out there, and there's a lot of food out there. They don't have to go very far to find what they want, you know, from food, water, and shelter. But when the leaves come off and the air moves more freely through that environment, the noise moves with that air, like they're just a lot more sensitive, a lot more irritable. And then the herd social pressure, you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, the herd social pressure is probably one of the bigger overlooked factors on a property. And that's why, you know, again, being intentional with those setups and understanding where are those does bedding on my property, more often than not, those does are going to be in that first layer of cover or the best bedding area closest to the high quality food source. That puts pressure on your bucks. If you don't have enough habitat or enough resources on a property or in a surrounding area in general, and you have too many does and that social pressure, they just push the bucks off you know, obviously during the rut, those bucks are going to come back through, but even then it's kind of a crapshoot where they're going to settle in because they can be anywhere with that number of does on the property. But then the last thing is obviously the human pressure, whether it's hunting pressure or human activity in the area. And I think the biggest thing with pressure that I've learned over the years, because the property that I hunt, primarily hunt, our home farm, I share with 17 other hunters. So in the beginning, I was always super, super frustrated. You know, they don't hunt at the same level of seriousness that I do. They don't invest the same amount of time. They're starting to invest more time, you know, whether it's just availability or, you know, they're starting to see the potential on this property. But I was always super frustrated with just the seemingly random activities on the property. And I never wanted to discourage anyone from coming and enjoying the property. And I always enjoyed spending time with them. Most of them are family members. But that level of pressure was always a problem until I started to understand that you can use pressure as a tool. And, you know, I'm not saying I condone high amounts of pressure on a property, but if you're creating enough attraction on a property, which the third of those four key elements is food, right? So food is obviously going to hold deer in an area and it's going to promote movement. So if we're increasing attraction with diverse food sources, really good native habitat, native forbs, a lot of good browse, and then strategically placed food plots, you know, in the most huntable areas, we're pulling deer in all the time. And then when they squirt out or they get pushed out because the pressure increases, if we're monitoring that pressure, we can really start to understand how those deer want to move and where they want to move when that pressure increases. And that's ultimately what has led to me killing some of my biggest deer. You know, and a lot of that comes to the timing element, that fourth element, which is where trail cameras play the biggest role, is understanding that timing. You know, things are so different early season versus late season when, you know, pressures changed, food sources have changed, all those things come into play. But again, there's all these elements and they're all intermingled together. And scouting is what's going to help you understand how those different elements interact with one another, especially on your own specific property.
Yeah, there's a lot there in everything you just conversed about. I like to call one of my, this is my technical term for this, it's called the deer suck. And, you know, once you create this vacuum effect on the property where it has all these nice attributes and the pressure just benefits you in some capacity and allows you to kind of understand and evaluate how they utilize the landscape, where they want to go when they're pressured. And then you build around that. So you build features that support that type of pressure. One topic that just came up recently in the podcast that will come out this following week here is surrounding how I put bedding in and utilize the pressure of the neighbors. I put the deer right in the line. They're looking at the neighbors. The neighbors come in, they go to my next bedding area. And they're so comforted in that fact. And the neighbors sit down below and they say, well, the deer see us. We see them. They know we're there and they won't come down this line. And it's, it just is interesting kind of thing or just way to look at the property kind of design and layout. And if they come in at the right distance and it's the right type of timber or open setting, the deer have that visual advantage. It isn't a bad time to actually construct bedding right on the line. And, you know, there's just a lot of strategy around different concepts. You know, one thing I've been mentioning recently, and you might be hearing more about this, is when I'm building some of the bedding areas, I'm actually stacking bucks within the bedding areas. Now, some individual bucks do not have preferences where they want to socialize, you know, with that resident doe herd, but some do, and some become more familiar. And a lot of these singular bucks that I've been finding that are older and older age class, they're intermingling with doe groups all season long. And they're not the anomaly or the exception to the rule. I have been able to create these environments that are more conducive to social interaction. And because everything is so bad around me, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but everything's degraded, the high value creates this high interest point. And so one example I spoke of recently to somebody else is, you take a property that's an island and you create, you know, this great environment, and you've got no real competition around you, maybe a little bit here and there, but it's miles away. You're on an island. They're able to socially congregate constructively. And it's almost like you can do that. I call them in peninsula properties or properties that are connected adjacent to other pieces, or even sandwich properties, properties that are in between other properties. And so if you create this great atmosphere, you may be surprised at the relative distance that the deer can relate now to each other. And so I'm trying to refute the point that depth of cover is actually really a thing. And I think one of the things you'll see on my property, and I've talked about this, is I've got food plots stacked all over the place. They're double compounded. They're linked. There's bedding. There's other bedding spots. There's different. I have tons of topography variation. So that dictates how I caught, where I put deer, how deer socially interact. And I monitor all that. In fact, that's probably the most critical aspect. If I take my pressure, you know, the human presence and activity out of the equation, my next focus point is how deer interact with each other, which are my tells on how I kill those deer. And if weather or wind or any climatic condition relates to that, that is a factor in my decision making. But sometimes it's more related to social interaction, which, like, people will be like, that's your factor. It could be number one in my stack of deck, in my cards here. So I just want to throw that out for people to consider, because everybody does this different. There's no way to cook this cat at this point. But I really feel like one of the things we have to pay attention to is, are these factors meaningful? And to Thomas's point earlier, you know, he rack and stack different factors. And I think you just sit there and say, all right, how do I relate to it? Does this resonate with my deer herd and my situation based on dynamics? You know, what's the hunting pressure in my area, et cetera? Am I changing that? Am I amplifying interest and just starting to put up this algorithm of success? And I see a lot of changes coming on these properties and people just being more open, so to speak, to complementing their hunting strategy now with this trail camera data and everything else that goes along with it. So I hope that complements some of your points there.
Yeah, no, I can completely agree with what you're saying. You know, stacking those bucks in or very near those doe bedding areas, I think it kind of comes down to one major factor, which is cover, right? So when it comes to pressure, what I always tell people is there's really only two things that reduce pressure on deer, and it's cover and consistency. You know, the consistent element, you get giant bucks that live in a city. You know, they live right in the city limits. Well, how does this giant deer put up with all this human pressure? Well, one, it's very consistent. And two, he knows he's not being hunted, right? So they stack right in there. There's no problems with it. The same goes on a client property. If I'm doing my pre-consultation call and there's a structure on that aerial photo I'm looking at, I always ask, is it a cabin or is it a house? If it's a house, it's got a lot more consistent activity. And I don't care if there's dogs barking in the backyard, kids playing, like our house here, I've got two young kids and we have dogs, right? They're always outside. We're always making commotion. But if they don't leave this bubble around the house very often, then the deer understand I can move through the cover. You know, I can stand in cover. I can feel safe and I'm fine. And then, you know, the cover element obviously makes a lot of sense too. How many times do you go driving through the woods on an ATV or down the road and there's a deer standing there in cover and they just stand really still and let you go right by? If they're out in the open, you know, they might stand still for a second, but as soon as you hesitate, they're gone. You know, and the same goes with bedding. And I agree with you. I don't really buy into the whole depth of cover thing. I think we know that that's kind of a punchline or a tagline that's used a lot by certain people, because I don't see that very often, especially on the properties that I hunt. There's not really a depth of cover situation. It's more so layers of cover or isolation cover. And topography is the greatest form of cover there is.
Absolutely. You know,
so I see that frequently too, where we'll get bucks, mature bucks that are, you know, I don't know with 100% certainty because I'm not monitoring them in the bedding areas, but they show up on the food source almost immediately after the does, and they all come from the same pocket of timber or the same corner. So we know that they're bedded very close. Well, I think if you break that down, you get in there and you can tell whether it's a spot that we've improved or just how that topography lays out. You know, the does might sit up here on the top edge of that field and the buck might be just over that knoll. I mean, he could be 10, 15, 20 yards away, but he's isolated. He's got some separation. He gets in there, he feels secure. And you know, all deer are different. So maybe there are bucks out there. More than likely, there's bucks out there that are looking at that doe group as an early warning sign, the same way a lot of bucks will use satellite bucks in a, you know, adjacent bedding areas where, like, if they spook out of there, then, you know, it's just one more thing to give me a warning to get out of there too.
I'm just going to add to this just slightly, and then I want to get to the next part of this. So I designed a property a few years ago, and I split a field in two. So one I let to go more of a successional stage field, you know, old field, but not any, I would say we didn't allow it to exceed 4 or 5 years in cover. And then we did it in pockets. And so we put bedding right up against that field, a variation of biological vegetation that's highly preferred. Now the diets vary. They do vary a little bit with bucks and does. And people start to see this on the landscape when you start to assess actually what deer are eating. So we stacked some does. Like, we put a bedding area right on the edge of the food plot, high protein diet, etc. Then we put a high phosphorus calcium diet right of that. And the bucks stacked right there and the does stacked right there. So they were side by side. And we had cover in between them. And so it was a good indicator. This is on my family farm. It was a good indicator what their preferences are and how they like to co-locate next to certain types of cover and related food. So, you know, having food value, variation in food value, a variation food type composition is really important. And so that's why when you're building some of these food plots, if you have high value food, and that doesn't mean it's got high crude protein, that could be, it's just engraced in high sugar content or whatever the case may be. And then adjacent to that, you have high phosphorus or calcium rich plants. And maybe you're managing the soils different in those areas too. You'll notice how the deer relate to those forms of food or form to cover. Now, one of the things I'm like instrumental in doing like right now is I make sure that those open, we'll just say open crops with low vegetation have some form of cover within the food plot. So that's where I have those strips within food plots. And at least, you know, there is some form of cover. It's the same concept with beans and corn. Once you throw corn in there, you really kind of rack and stack a few more deer just with those, the little aspect of taller vegetation in that food source. So I think it's important to kind of look at this as there isn't one size fits all. There's variation in this. Food sometimes dictates interest, as does cover. A combination thereof could be your best bet because you're kind of weighing both of those in this matrix of building, you know, a food source or a cover source. And it's weighing those in concert. And I come up with percentages of what species I want here and what's the space requirement there, et cetera, and just kind of compounding on what this physically needs to look like. Because in my mind, I got this artistic drawing of what I think it should look like. And that always like ebbs and flows with Mother Nature. So I don't want to take too much more time this. I want to get into some of the specific details. We've been on this 35 minutes. We got to move. What do you feel like when you're taking this data in makes people successful? Because it's one thing to take information. It's another thing to be actionable about it. And I think that's where you can teach us a thing or two because you've had a long time to look at a lot of data.
Yeah. I don't know if there's any one like specific or key thing in general. You know, I think across the board, it's observation. And, you know, I guess if I was going to lean on one thing, it would be flexibility with that. You know, I think it's very easy to come up with an idea on how something's going to play out in your head. You know, you just play out that scenario. I've put all this time in, I've fine-tuned this spot. This is where I'm going to kill this deer. And I'm going to do it the first week in November, the last week of October, whatever it might be. And things change all the time. You know, something might happen on that property. Something might happen on the neighbor's property, whatever it might be. So being flexible with that situation and adjusting ever so slightly, I think is a big, big factor, at least in my success. You know, one of the big things on the trail camera topic, I'm not a huge proponent of cell cameras. I think cell cameras are great. You know, everyone again loves real-time information or that quick gratification. You know, I just put the cell camera up yesterday. I'm already getting pictures on it. So it's cool to see that versus waiting a month or two and going back and pulling that card. But I think the biggest disadvantage with a cell camera is you're not immersed in that situation. You're not out in that environment. And you're also getting this kind of trickle of information that comes in. So I'm a huge fan of going out, pulling a card, scouting, you know, that surrounding area. You know, how many times you go in and check a camera that's a non-cell camera, or maybe you have to change the batteries in a cell camera, or something happens, tree branch goes down, you get in there and something like that, you know, a tree went down, it altered the trail system, or that mock scrape you have right there isn't really getting hit that much, but there's a scrape 15 yards away that the deer opened up and they're really using that. And, you know, that back to that sampling rate, you know, camera only telling you what's going on. it might still be a very good spot, but you're not getting the intel because those deer are, you know, they've altered their movement just a little bit. And it could really affect you if you, you know, say you have three or four cameras out on the property and you're kind of just playing it off of what you're getting purely from the cameras alone. It could affect you negatively in that situation. But the bigger thing that I think people overlook is our brains are really good at processing information. If you train yourself just a little bit to know what to look for, right? There's that reticular activating system in your brain that actually builds a playlist. It's a neurological system that builds a playlist of observation in your brain. Are you familiar with this?
No, I'm not.
So the easiest way to explain it, or the best example of it and how that functions, is if you ever go to a car dealership looking to buy a new vehicle, and you know, you go there, you're kind of shopping around, you're exploring options, and you pick a make or model or maybe a color that you really like. It's new to you. Ah, man, I've never really noticed this before, but I like it. As soon as you leave there, you start seeing that vehicle or that color all over town. And you've never really noticed it before. You've programmed your brain, that reticular activating system, to pick up on that thing in your environment. Without this neurological system in our brain, we'd be overwhelmed by everything. I already have high operating level of ADD, which, you know, it's one of those things where you pick up on a lot of details, right? So it's hard enough to filter out all the details, sure, which is a blessing and a curse. But without this reticular activating system, we would just be overwhelmed all the time. So it tells our brain what to notice and what not to notice. And if we train our brain to look for certain things while we're out in the woods, certain elements, certain features, then we start to pick up on that information that really is valuable to us or to our cause. So when we go out there and we scout our way in, we scout the surrounding area, we pull that card, whatever it might be. You know, I'm a big fan of jumping on my e-bike in the fall, zipping around, and I've got a handful of cameras that I can take one step in the woods, or it's on a trail leading out in the field. You know, you're in, you're out, you're not bothering anything. Try to time it where the wind's not pushing into a bedding area. You know, you're still smart about it. But then you go back and you sit down at that computer, you know, old school mode, right? We're not waiting for film to be developed anymore. Not that old school, but we're taking the SD card, we're putting it in the computer, and then in chronological order, we're scrolling through everything that happened in that specific spot, right? So now we went and we were in the physical environment. Now we know exactly what things look like now. Let's back up and see what got us to that point. Is there a lot of activity in that area? We're scrolling through the card. You see activity increase, and you know this buck's been using it a bunch. Is there not a lot of activity in that area? We're scrolling through the card. There's been people trespassing, an influx of coyotes. You know, I've had situations where I had a camera that was just hot, just absolutely hot one year, and all of a sudden just shut off. And I went out there and I checked it, and what happened was a yearling fawn got hung up in the fence and died, and it ended up being, you know, basically the coyotes were there every single day for a month picking at this carcass. So that obviously is going to alter how deer move through that area at that point. You know, I've had it before where, again, a tree went down 20 yards up trail and it pushed that deer movement down halfway down the hill. So now this ridgetop travel corridor that was really hot completely altered it. The deer were still moving through there. I could still make the shot from my tree stand location down that hill, but they weren't showing up on that camera. So, you know, sometimes it can be a matter of twisting that camera slightly, get a better angle, whatever it might be. But the level of observation and allowing your brain, you know, first and foremost, training your brain of what to look for, which really only comes with repetition, you know, just like any other aspect of training, repetition is key. But training your brain and then allowing your brain to process that information and looking for those little, what I refer to as breadcrumbs, you know, what is that one thing? And, you know, sometimes it's very obvious. Sometimes you have to dig deeper. I always go back to those four key elements. And I would say of those four key elements, wind is one of the most important factors. You know, again, pressure moves deer, and we can look at that as a tool and how it moves deer, but understanding how those deer move on any given day with whatever source of pressure it is largely dictated by the wind. You know, that was one of the very few things, not to throw shade at or discredit my family growing up, but you know, we were pretty traditional deer camp type family. That was how I was raised. You know, it was beat the brush until you bump something out that you want to shoot at. And that's what it was. It was a lot of shooting at things, not shooting things. But the one thing that I learned hunting with them my whole life is that a pressured deer runs into the wind. 9.9 times out of 10, that deer is going to run into the wind. There might be the odd situation where they, you know, they hook around, they cut around, they're following cover for a minute, but they're always going to get that wind in their face to get that advantage. So every time we'd set up to make a deer drive, whichever way the wind was blowing, you knew that that's where most of the deer were going to squirt out of that chunk of timber, right? So I can look at that. You can dial back, you know, this is, I take notes on all the pressure stuff, even on trail cameras. If I'm going through my trail cameras, this is another reason why I like to sit down and go through that information one card at a time. And there's human activity, whatever it might be. I see the, you know, I've got cameras set up on a lot of fence crossings. I'm a huge proponent, and I push this on all my clients to have cameras in the exit and entrance corridors of your property. You know, a lot of people are hunting small properties in general, but even if it's a really deep property, figure out where those deer are slipping out of the property and where they're coming back in, and put a camera up over that. Even if it's a camera, you know, it's a non-sell, again, let it soak all year. But if I'm out checking another camera and I notice some type of pressure or human activity, I'll jot it down. You know, I'm not writing down every time I see a coyote or something like that, but if there's human activity on the property, you know, the neighbor's cattle got out and then they're in there trying to get them out of there. You know, I almost killed a buck a couple of years ago because of that exact reason. He got blown out of this valley. And then I was able to find out on another camera that the heifers from the neighboring property got into this valley and they were in there trying to get them out, push the deer out. That will tell you where those deer are moving and also, you know, maybe where they were. So if I just jot down, you know, date and time of this activity, I can always go back and look at the weather history. What was the wind direction that morning? Okay, that morning wind direction more than likely is what placed that buck in a given bedding area. He's got that survival advantage. And then what was the wind doing that afternoon? Because that more often than not is going to dictate how he moves, whether he's pressured or he's just moving towards a food source in a higher pressured area. He wants that wind in his advantage at some point, right?
Yeah.
So looking back at that wind is huge. And like I said before, it's one of the more easily monitored aspects of it, because you can always go back and look at the weather history data and get a ballpark idea. You know, you can predict that by looking at the forecast, you know, with that timing element, when we were talking a short-term time frame, you know, what day this week do I want to hunt? Or, you know, what time of day do I hunt in the morning, in the afternoon? I look at that weather forecast and I look at wind directions, wind changes more than I look at temp drops. More often than not, when the wind changes, you have a temp drop anyways, or temp rise, right?
Sure.
But the wind change, I think, dictates so much with those bucks. And again, the higher the pressure is in the area, the more they rely on that wind for that survival advantage.
And that's, I spot on with that. The one thing that I struggle with, but I've been able to get a lot better at this, is I look at the wind from a macro level, and then I zoom in. One of the things that I kind of focus on, at least from my standpoint, is what is the overarching topography post leaf drop or during leaf drop? How can I cut areas of timber to recycle wind better, to move and flow wind better into these bedding areas? So there'll be opposing wind options where I can keep deer in areas where, regardless of the direction, because I can shape the way the direction initially hits. So if a wind is coming, let's just say westerly, I can turn it easterly with the way that I cut the timber. And so shaping now the timber cuts specifically to recycle wind better in those areas keeps deer in those bedding areas longer. The other thing that was cool when I was a kid, so this is in like 1997, and we were deer hunting with my cousins, and boy, man, those guys like to run and gun. We drove deer like nobody's business, and I miss those days. And wind bumping deer in the 90s, late 90s was our thing. We would wind bump deer. Like, everyone's like, oh, you know, man, I was doing that with these old time farmers. And these guys are old time farmers. Wind bumping deer, you know, the wind would be coming over the back. They'd bump them, and then the deer would come and they'd turn around. They'd sneak through the drivers. So then we'd hold two drivers back to catch those in between to push those deer so they wouldn't kick out the sides. So you got really smart on how to drive deer and how they use landscape. I mean, this is in when I was 16 years old, and you're studying how they deal with pressure and they run through areas. And obviously as the season went on, they got really smart when people came through, and you know, they'd find those little isolated pockets. And fortunately, my dad was smart enough to know that we weren't going to drive our own property, because everyone would drive, you know, the deer on our 100 acres, and that little 26 acre woodlot was holding some pretty nice deer. And then my cousins would wait for us to leave, and then they would go attack our property.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you look at those things and you say, you know, you can learn a lot by driving deer on your own property and figure out, and I'm not recommending this, but if you're not concerned with it, maybe it's later in the season, see how they respond to your pressure. You know, it could be a good observation for you to see, you know, how they move when you actually physically apply pressure to them. I do that on my own property, and I do it like consistently in the summertime just to see if they use certain areas and the way they use them. And it's amazing watching deer just move through vegetation and just paying attention to, you know, you think you got this open trail that a deer naturally wants to go through, and all of a sudden they go through this entire debris that you couldn't even imagine crawling through. And you're like, how did that deer get through that in like 4 seconds? It would take me 15 minutes to crawl through. And so, you know, there's things about this that are meaningful, and how you cut timber, how you lay out adjacent bedding areas. We talked about the layering of cover within bedding areas, the segregation piece of this, and just trying to get, you know, a better understanding of why they want to use the landscape a certain way, I think is ultimately the most important thing. The ins and outs, you know, I usually take camera data on the outs because I don't have enough cameras to take it on the in locations, and at least tells me where they're leading to. And then it gives me a cycle of timeline. Timeline's critical on this. And you started out with like one of the best like dialogues. Are you telling yourself the story? What's the story of this particular deer? I don't think people are kind of walking through what the story could be, or alternatively, they have a story and they're so biased by what's going on around them. They have all these preconceived like ideas and concepts that honestly are not even close to being remotely correct. And I mean, working with most of my clients, that's a huge part of the issue. They're so biased by all this false advertising and poor information. They're like, man, I got to buy this scent. I got to do this thing. I got to use this camera. It's got to be a soak. I mean, and it's just like, you know, you got my partner who, you know, Hillbilly Josh, you know, great buddy of mine. And he just goes, well, John, we just like to sit down on that log there and just shoot them. I know where they're going to be. And knowing the landscape and trying to read it, it's an art. I mean, there's a science aspect of it, but it's how you process data. I don't know what the saying is to this, but there's something where you to ingest data, and the guys that can process it at a really fast rate and react to it. I meet a lot of these guys from time to time in different areas and businesses and clients, and I'm just amazed at how quickly they can do that. But they've, like you said earlier, they've practiced it over and over. It's the repetition of that allows them to be super effective. So if you just go into your woods and you're just like, oh, I'm going to cut some trees, or oh, I'm going to do this, and you're not really taking the time to kind of assess and observe, you're really not learning a whole lot about what's going on your property. And I think during hunting season is really not the time to be learning things. And a lot of people are trying to learn during the hunting season. You made a good point earlier. If things aren't like dialing in, or things aren't kind of equating to what you suspect would be, yeah, you probably got to go in there and take a look. But naturally, I mean, you know, if things are going okay and everything is to plan, maybe sometimes you're taking this data after the fact and reassessing, you know, how they're using it. For those that don't have a lot of snow, I always feel bad for you. I mean, I get tons of snow here, so I'm able to kind of look at what's going on real time. I got real data. I don't even need cameras at that point. And, you know, that's the huge, you know, element of living in the North is I've got real time data that isn't trail camera data. I might not know exactly the timeline they're in there, but I have a rough idea within 12 hours. And at the same point, I know how they're using the landscape. And is it to the form, the fit and form and function that I expect it to be? I think that's really critical kind of, you know, when you step back and look at your own property. So we're getting to the end of this. I don't like going as long as we went right now. So anything you want to end on, you're going to be back, right? This is just one of our conversations. So anything you want to end on with you, something we can give the audience that may be a good ending, something that's important that may help them propel them into the season. Cause I think people want, give me an answer. And people like small bits of data. So what's something that would be helpful?
Yeah, I think you kind of just said it here a second ago, knowing that landscape, and this is another reason why I'm not a huge proponent of cell cameras. I think there's a time and a place for them, but going out and scouting your property and pressuring your property are two different things. So if you're scouting with kind of a hunting mindset, you're still, utilizing scent control. You're still paying attention to what that wind direction's doing. You're still putting together a theory and trying to prove or disprove that theory. But I do think it's important for people to get out on their property during the hunting season, at least from time to time, because think about what that landscape looks to you during the summertime. And even during the wintertime when there's a pile of snow and if you don't have a lot of deer on your property, you probably don't have the best winter habitat anyway. So like in your situation, you can go out and read those tracks and those trail systems in the snow because you have the deer there. But if you don't have any deer there, maybe you have deer there early in the season, early in the fall, throughout the summer, whatever it might be. And then it kind of dwindles off throughout the fall. It might be very advantageous for you to get out and scout. So one of the things that I really like to do is go out in the rain. Pick a rainy day or a really, really windy day in the fall. I mean, that's how I killed my buck last fall, was going out. I had a hunch on where he was. I had this theory. I was trying to prove or disprove this theory. And essentially, I just went out there to scout my way along the edge of this bedding area. And I ended up finding this buck bedded down. I shot him in his bed after a 4-hour stalk. But again, going out there and understanding that landscape is huge. And I had never actually approached that spot from that angle that time of year because I knew it was a bedding area and I was always very hesitant to disturb it. But that day, the wind was just perfect. It was roaring out of the south. I got out there right at first light and I just took my time and it worked out for me. He killed a 150-inch 8-pointer in his bed, the buck that I was after all season. So those are those situations where, if the story's not going to play out, that's the thing. You have to be honest with yourself. So one takeaway I would say for anyone listening is come up with those theories. It's visualization. You mentioned this early on, like you have this vision of how you want this property to lay out. You have this vision on how you want to structure a food plot, whatever it might be. Visualization is extremely important on every aspect, every level. You can draw out things on a map, but there's a lot of different variables involved in killing these deer, especially consistently killing them. So visualize how that's going to play out. I try all the way down to which trail is that deer going to come in? Where is he going to stop? Whether, again, it's a very customized curtailed setup where I think he's going to stop at a scrape or a water hole or the edge of a food plot, whatever it might be, or I'm adjusting and I'm set up in a new spot in the same area. Play that out all the way down to the shot sequence, but have a vision. And if things aren't going your way throughout that season, every year's a building year, right? Every year's a building year. So don't be afraid to get a little bit more aggressive. Don't be afraid to make mistakes as long as you're learning, right? And you've probably learned this in that business world. I'm sure we have a lot of similar clients when you break down the personality types. Everything is a growing opportunity. So there's no such thing as failures. They're just learning experiences. And all the way back to this information collection, data analysis, what your brain is recognizing as valuable information. Go into those situations trying to learn. Approach it without the assumption that you know everything that's going to happen. Again, the best thing I can tell people time and time again is come up with the best theory you can. The more information that you have, the more precise your theory can be. But come up with the best theory you can, then try to prove or disprove that theory, whether it's hunting or putting a trail camera out to get those pictures of that buck moving through that area under a certain set of conditions that you recognize. That's a big thing. Because if you're just hunting willy-nilly, and that's fine. I don't want to take that away from anyone. A lot of people just want to put a little bit of time in here and there, and they leave their success largely up to luck. And that's okay. Guys like you and I and most of our clients are putting a lot of time and or money into these properties. And a lot of times the difference between their success and their failure is just one extra step of observation or paying attention to what's going on and adjusting things, fine-tuning them. Because I can put a lot of time in on a property, but I can only take a person so far. They still ultimately have to make that final decision, whether it's where to hold on that animal, how to breathe when they're at full draw so they don't black out and miss the deer, punch the trigger, or picking the day and the place that they need to be on that property. Everyone has that story. Some people have a story of this spot being the best spot, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Situations change all the time. So every year is a building year. Always try to learn. I try to approach the woods from a student perspective. What can I learn today? You know, if I can prove a theory, then I learned certain elements of that theory. If I can't prove it or it's disproven altogether, then I have to go back and adjust and come up with a new theory and try again and just try again. That's basically all you're trying to do. And that's honestly, I think that's the funnest part of the hunt is that chess match, right? You know, how do you get that one step ahead? How do you predict that movement? And when you finally get that checkmate situation, that's the most rewarding, I feel.
Yeah. I've got nothing else to say. He said it all. All right. I think we're done today, and we'll have you back again. And this is my first video podcast that I've done on my own, so I hope the recording works out okay. But I appreciate your time. I think you're going to be a great contributor to this podcast. I mean, I feel like this, we got the best of the best on this. And, you know, I'm fortunate to participate with a lot of you all, and I appreciate you even considering, you know, supporting, you know, this platform. So thanks for taking time with me, and we'll be in touch, and look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Thanks for having me on, John. Take care.
All right, brother. See ya. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.